Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C. Pope Benedict dies at 95 Saturday.
That was sorrow. We inform you that the Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI passed away today, this morning, at 9:34 in the Mater Ecclesiae Monastery in the Vatican. And the other information that I provided in Italian is that on Wednesday the 28th, in the afternoon, he had received the anointing of the sick in the monastery at the end of the Holy Mass.
We have indicated more than one time that there are two big countries which are hosting forces of hostility and that they are allowing their soul to be used as a launching lily pad to assassinate members of the National Security Services in the Kingdom of Eswatini. And we are now experiencing a second wave or another dimension.
Eswatini government sharply condemns violence targeting security officers and civilians.
The investigation panel has been set up in order to find out the truth, the involvement, and all what it contains, as it has been reported that there was an attempted foil coup d'etat.
And the Gambian government forms a commission to investigate the recent coup attempt to topple President Adama Barrow's government. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, who will forever be remembered as the first pontiff in 600 years to resign from the job, died Saturday. He was 95. Matteo Bruni, the director of the Vatican Press Office in Rome, made the announcement a few hours ago and shared some of the plans for the funeral.
That was sorrow. We inform you that the Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI passed away today, this morning, at 9:34 in the Mater Ecclesiae Monastery in the Vatican. And the other information that I provided in Italian is that on Wednesday the 28th, in the afternoon, he had received the anointing of the sick in the monastery at the end of the Holy Mass, and that the funerals will be on Thursday this coming week, Thursday the 5th of January, at 9:30 on St. Peter's Square, and they will be presided over by Pope Francis. And as we already told you this morning, from the morning of Monday, the body of the Pope Emeritus will be in the Basilica of St. Peter's, where the faithful can go with their prayers for a last meeting with the Pope Emeritus to greet him and to say goodbye. Bene.
That was Matteo Bruni, the director of the Vatican Press Office in Rome. A teacher of theology and author of 22 books, Monsignor Kevin Irwin, was a professor at Catholic University during then Pope Benedict's 2008 visit to campus. He also was a national media expert following the death of Pope John Paul II and election of Pope Benedict. He was in Rome in 2013 when Pope Benedict resigned and Pope Francis was elected. He recently talked to my colleague Yehias Wahib regarding Pope Benedict's legacy to the Roman Catholic Church.
Now, his legacy about Benedict will be a very, very strong, positive legacy when it comes to things about theology and church teaching. He began as a brilliant professor in Germany and was very involved in Vatican II in drafting those documents, being a consultant to one of the cardinals, and was very involved in theology as he evolved through Vatican II and into his papacy. On the other side, I would say, as far as when he was pope, I would say that it's a mixed legacy, because none of us have all the gifts that we could possibly need to be a pope. And he lacked some insight about finances, confidentiality of Vatican documents. And while he did step up a bit about the abuse crisis, it just got away from him. And he realized it was time to go.
Monsignor, how would you compare him with his predecessor, Pope John Paul II and his successor, Pope Francis?
Well, I would put it this way. I would put them in succession. John Paul certainly was a very, very fine philosopher, how to think, how to organize ideas. He wanted to get the Catholic Church organized after Vatican II. So he sponsored the catechism. He sponsored a new canon law. He was a man who wanted to systematize and pull things together and gave us rich, rich documents about philosophy. I would say that Ratzinger, as the Pope, was basically a theologian. He gave us encyclicals on faith, hope, and charity. He also, quite frankly, when he worked in Rome before becoming Pope, he was basically assisting John Paul II with all of those writings. So I might say that in some ways, Ratzinger was John Paul II's footnotes. He was a very fine scholar who I think theologically refined a lot of things. And then we have a pope who is, I call the consummate pastoral pope. Now, Francis stands in contrast to 32 years of John Paul and Benedict, giving us a style of pope which is heavily teaching oriented. This man all teaches, but he certainly walks the walk and talks the talk. And in that sense, he's a much more present to the people and present to the world's problems.
And lastly, Monsignor, some Catholics and those who study the Church have seen Benedict and Pope Francis as reflecting different trends in the faith, with Pope Benedict Emeritus as seen as more of a traditionalist and Pope Francis as being more progressive. Do you think that is an accurate perception?
I think Benedict was very concerned to continue the teaching of Vatican II in a way that was systematic and organized. And I think that Pope Francis is continuing Vatican II by building on Vatican II with different, he's taking a couple of leaps, for example, to interreligious dialogues become very important for him. The environment was more important for him. They're in continuity, but I want to suggest that Ratzinger, as the Pope, was concerned with Vatican II being taught. Francis, I think, uses Vatican II as a jumping off point to enter other things.
Monsignor Kevin Erwin is professor of theology at Catholic University. He spoke to my colleague Yehez Wuhib from Washington, D.C. The president of Zambia, Hakainde Hichilema, has signed into law a measure that abolishes the death penalty. The move makes the Southern African country the latest in Africa to end the punishment. Both local and international human rights organizations have hailed the move. They call on countries in Southern Africa to learn from Zambia's example and to do the same. Supporters of the government say abolishing the punitive measure was a key campaign promise Hichilema made as the main opposition leader ahead of the recent general election. To learn more about the reasoning behind the president's decision, the process followed, and what remains to be done, I reach via Skype Justice Minister Mulambo Haimbe.
For the last 25 years, we have had a moratorium. We were a de facto abolitionist state. But then, of course, as everybody will be aware, if the law is not specifically changed, there could be a situation in a de facto abolitionist state where one day somebody gets executed. And so a bold step, a bold decision was made because of our international obligations, because of our very own ethos that we follow in the Republic of Zambia. Under the newly elected government, which we were elected in 2021, we took the decision. His Excellency the President gave the political will to say, let's make this a de jure abolitionist state. That is to say, let the law itself provide no longer for the death penalty. And really, that's the long and short of it. Of course, behind that, there's a moral decision. Around the fact that nobody should take the life of another. And we want to stand by those ethos. And the best way of doing so was to, forgive the expression, to walk the talk and ensure that this work was done.
Well, Mr. Justice Minister, talk to me about the process that was followed. Is it legal? Is it legitimate? Can the government defend it, legally speaking? And is it in accordance with the Zambian constitution? Because as you know, you are a lawyer. Lawyers can always bring things up and challenge it in court.
And the constitution says everyone is guaranteed the right to life. Then it provides an exception to the effect that where there is a decision of a court of competent jurisdiction that allows for execution to take place, then an execution would take place pursuant to that. We had in our statute book the death penalty for capital offences. And what essentially we did was to say, let's take away the possibility of a court pronouncing a death sentence for anybody by repealing the provisions in the Penal Code and the Criminal Procedure Code such that no court can then pronounce a death penalty going forward following the assent of the amendment bills that were put before the floor of the House. And so with effect from 23rd December 2022, when the president assented to the bills that were before the House, there is no longer in the statute book any provision that allows for a court to pronounce a death sentence for capital offences. The capital offences were murder, treason, and aggravated robbery.
Well, Mr. Justice Minister, talk to me what remains to be done in the post-abolishment implementation period, if you may.
So now the judicial system has to shift to the new dispensation, which is the substitution of the death penalty for life imprisonment. So the first thing is for the judiciary, which is an independent arm of government, to embed this and make sure that all superior court judges are brought to speed on the implications of what has been done. But more importantly, we are alive to the fact that there is need for closure on the part of the victims and the families of the victims of capital offences. And so we are now looking to grow a robust way in which we can assist the various families, the various victims, to find closure, because closure is also an important part of the whole process. Also, there is need to upscale the skills of our law enforcement agencies so that we are able to more effectively monitor, ensure that as much as is humanly possible, we detect these capital offences before they take place and put a preventive measures in place.
Well, Mr. Justice Minister, before you go, what has been the reaction from the Zambian population? Because on the one hand, some people are saying that the president has kept his promise, and others are saying, well, it's just a publicity stunt just to get international attention and favour. How are Zambians reacting to that?
You are quite right. In any situation such as this, there will be mixed reactions. There are those who continue to believe that the death sentence, the death penalty, was a deterrent factor. But all the scientific evidence that has been put forward does not support that, especially that we had a 25-year moratorium. So anybody committing the offences would have known over the last 25 years that the likelihood of execution is almost zero. But then it's a sensitization issue, and that is why I mentioned earlier the need for us to put in place robust measures, robust provisions to sensitize the public, to allow for institutions to grow that will bring in the means to allow foreclosure. So it's baby steps, but the most important has been taken.
Mulambo Haimbe is Zambia's Justice Minister. He spoke with me via Skype from the capital, Lusaka. The government of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, is calling on neighboring countries to expel individuals who use their countries to launch violent attacks on the kingdom's security officers and institutions. This after the administration in Mbabani launched an investigation into the recent killings of security officers and civilians. Officials say it appears some individuals are in possession of illegal weapons they used in the attacks. The government condemned the attacks and vowed to thoroughly investigate and prosecute those responsible. The administration also says it has petitioned the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, to help resolve its concerns about neighboring countries that allow their territory to be used to launch attacks on the kingdom. For the latest developments, I reach government spokesperson Alpheios Nkrumalo.
We have indicated more than one time that there are two big countries which are hosting forces of hostility and that they are allowing their soil to be used as a launching lily pad to assassinate members of the National Security Services in the Kingdom of Eswatini, And we are now experiencing a second wave or another dimension where some members of civilians are being abducted or kidnapped from their places of abode, taken into killer and slaughtered in forests. So the Kingdom of Eswatini is alarmed at the state in which these escalations and sporadic killings or attempted killings to some of our officers who have escaped through their tactics of exchanging fire. We are grappling with the problem, but we are investigating, and we are sure that pretty very soon the culprits shall be brought to book.
But isn't these serious allegations against two neighboring countries that you are making, that they are allowing their soil to be used as a ground to attack your kingdom? Wouldn't this cause a diplomatic rift between your country and theirs?
There's no diplomatic abroad that you can spark more than hosting forces that are attacking your neighbor. In SADC, we have got agreements and we've got protocols relating on how we are going to jointly manage and arrest terrorists. And then if terrorists have found sanctuary in your country, you are giving sanctuary to terrorists, are taking your neighbors, and we are responding to that anomaly. How do you think that will spark a diplomatic uproar? Because a diplomatic uproar is already there. It has already been triggered by the fact that you are hosting forces of hostility to your neighbors.
Has your government officially petitioned these two countries not to host these hostile actors? And has your government petitioned, perhaps, taking it to SADC to resolve these concerns that you have?
We are definitely in the process of doing that. Diplomatic letters of consent have been sent, because you must remember, SADC operates as a bloc, like the European Union. So every concern, every communication that we make, we direct it to the appropriate channels. For instance, in SADC, we have a troika responsible for politics and security. That's where most of these matters are reported to.
Well, Mr. Nkumalo, there are concerns that talks encouraged by even SADC to try to resolve any politically related tension in the Kingdom of Eswatini have been ignored by the government, which they said the government has also gone ahead to attack pro-democracy activists in the country. They ran away to other countries and they are causing this problem. Will there be any attempt or effort by the government to try to encourage a dialogue to resolve these tensions that most people have described, including the pro-democracy activists, have called for?
My brother, you will remember that it is not the first time the two of us have been in this platform discussing the same question. The position remains the same. There is no government that internationally, within the international framework of dealing with terrorists and terrorism, that can engage terrorists into negotiations. That is number one. There is no government that can be forced to negotiate at gunpoint. There is no government that can negotiate seated on a table that is blood of innocent civilians, innocent people are flowing under that negotiating table. It is not going to happen in our lifetime. This is the international position. That is the non-civic organizations in the country that have raised one concern or the other about, for instance, our electoral process, about the political formations to have the right to participate in the elections of the country, for which we have got no law that prevents them from doing so.
Alpheus Nkrumalo is the spokesperson for the Eswatini government. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. The government in The Gambia has formed a commission to investigate the recent coup attempt to topple President Adama Barrow's government.
The 11-member panel will inquire into the attempted overthrow condemned by government officials, international partners, and the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, a regional bloc. But critics of the government say the coup attempt and the subsequent announcement to investigate it is an attempt by the government to divert public attention over its inability to resolve the challenges facing the country. They say the government has become unpopular due to the high price of goods and services. The authorities have so far arrested 8 soldiers and a civilian in the plot to carry out the attempted coup. For more on the panel to investigate the attempt to overthrow the government, I reach Information Minister Lamine Quinjame.
The investigation panel has been set up in order to find out the truth, the involvement, and all what it contains, as it has been reported that there was an attempted foil coup d'etat. And in a democratic setting, it is important that evidences are provided, that the organs of government act on matters of law as provided for in the laws. And that is primarily the reason why it has been set up.
Has the government given the panel a time frame within which to operate and to provide its report and recommendations?
Yes, certainly a timeline is given. That is the target. I may not remember because for some reasons, but I know that a timeline, a reasonable timeline is really given within which the investigation is to be done to finish.
Some people are suggesting that the coup attempt was not a coup attempt at all, and that it is a distraction, a ploy by the government to distract attention from the challenging economic prevailing conditions with high food prices, high inflation, and the likes. And that this is just a distraction attempt to claim that an attempted coup was done in order to tighten security and clamp down on opposition. How do you respond to that?
But this would be the small minority, a very minute fraction of the population, if you like. The government of President Adama Barrow is known for the credence it has in democracy and the respect for human and fundamental human rights and the rule of law. There have been, if it is the prevailing economic conditions, we have been in that since when? Since during the COVID period. But there was never a moment when any attempt of government was made to point to any group of people, large or small, to allege them for any involvement in illegal matters such as a coup d'etat. So it is therefore completely wrong for anybody to carry that notion that the president and the administration of the government of the Gambia has done this in order to distract public attention. Far away from that, the evidences, the investigation of the panel will prove, I hope, in the end, what the truth had been.
Family members of some of the alleged coup plotters or the masterminds behind the alleged coup attempt are saying that the people cited are just scapegoats that the government is using and that they had no hand in the alleged coup attempt. Everything is shrouded in secrecy and pointing accusing fingers at scapegoating some segment of the population who necessarily do not support the president's agenda or voted for him. What's your response to that, Mr. Information Minister?
That is completely wrong. That is not a correct story. Without preempting anything of the findings of the investigation panel, I am saying the panel, I hope in the end, will come out with results. However, you must also understand that yes, in a democracy, in any natural social setting, people would always try to justify whatever they do. But the fact of the matter stands that the democratically elected government of the Gambia should be sacrificed in that way. And much as you consider what had been said by some concerned people, also look generally at what is being said by institutions within the Gambia and outside the Gambia, all of them jointly condemning the attempted coup. And this is the truth. So that if it is not their making, honestly, investigation will prove this. But government will also not succumb to any condition by a small group of people expressing opinion, which is only seen as an opinion. It has not been extracted out of any formal, any professional investigation, any serious concern. These are only expressions of opinion. The majority of Gambians know that President Adama Barrow and his government are law-abiding, and they fundamentally believe government had legal encounters where in some of them he won, government won, and of course in some we lost. And all this was appreciated in the spirit of the prevalence of the rule of law. So we are not expecting, it is not individual opinion which is important in this. What is important in this is the truth of the matter. What investigation will prove, what evidences would be available, and at the end of the day, that determines what has been done.
Lamine Quinjame is the Gambia's information minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. Human rights defenders and civil society groups are calling on the Nigerian police to fire errant officers or, quote, bad apples from the organization. This, the groups say, will ensure police officers carry out their mandate to maintain law and order. Their call came after the National Bar Association, or NBA, condemned the shooting death of one of their members, Bolanle Rahim, by a police officer in the country's commercial capital, Lagos. Local media quoted representatives of the NBA branch in Lagos, where the victim was a member, say the group will demand at least $12 million in compensation and damages for the killing of Rahim. For the latest developments on the murder of the lawyer, I reach Abiye Tam George. She is the vice chair of the Lagos branch of the NBA and chairperson of the Human Rights Commission.
It has gone beyond the NBA Lagos branch. It is now the national body, which is the Nigerian Bar Association, that is in charge. So ordinarily, because the NBA Lagos branch constitutes the location upon which this incident had happened, and so it started off with us trying to investigate this matter, ascertain the veracity of some of the information that we have gathered. And so we went to the DPO's office, the CP, the Commissioner of Police, the bereaved family, and all of that. Our demands are normally very straightforward, which is that there will be a criminal prosecution of the suspect as well as the civil remedies from the stakeholders.
Will there be also remedies against the police, since it's the police administration or service that trained this alleged officer who is accused of killing one of your members?
Exactly. So he's going to be the key. The suspect is actually one of the key persons that will have to be punished. All right, or compensation being derived from as a result of his direct involvement. But there are all kinds of contributory negligence and lack of proper care and all of that that will be subsumed in order to bring in the DPO, the Commission of Police, the IGP, the Police Service Commission, and all of that. The suspect is key in this regard.
So, Mrs. Abide, as a lawyer yourself, a human rights defender as well, what is the state of the investigation that the NBA Lagos branch carried out or undertook following the murder of one of your members?
I think that with what has happened so far, we are, though I say we are pleased, because ordinarily investigations of this nature could take 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, 1 week, 1 month, and all of that. But by the time we left the CP's office, they assured us that within 42 hours, he's going to send his recommendation to the IGP, and the IGP will likewise either adopt or vary his recommendation. But I think the IGP had head to the recommendation of the CP, which is suspension, so that all the processes will go along, which is that it will be properly be taken to a magistrate called for a remand order, and then the DPP will have to bring his legal advice, and then the matter will proceed. From all indications, everything is going on as planned. The pressure and our intervention and our insistence that this matter will have to be expeditiously dealt with. And that is going on record.
Nigerians have condemned the murder. There is an ongoing excessive use of force by police, errant police officers that need thorough investigation and the bad apples weeded out. What is your reaction to some of these concerns by Nigerians?
So they are not far-fetched. They are very correct. As we speak, they are still ongoing. So part of what we did to commemorate International Human Rights Day, just about the 6th of December, we held a dialogue with the AIG and senior police officers from Ogun State and Lagos State. So about 50 of them were in attendance. And our position is that there is need to implement the Pan-African modern police law for Africa, right? And surprisingly, a lot of them are not even aware of this law. So what we're trying to do is to form this collaboration, understanding that policing is very critical. There is need for training, reorientation, evaluation, assessment, and a lot of reforms needed to take place. And structures, you know, that will not only make reports, but follow up to its logical conclusion when there are all of these abuses of human rights.
Abiye Tam George is the vice chair of the Lagos branch of the NBA and chairperson of the Human Rights Commission. She spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. In Ghana, the leader of the opposition All People's Congress, or APC, says prevailing economic conditions are making life difficult for citizens. Businessman Hassan Ayariga, who is a possible presidential candidate for the coming 2024 general election, says high inflation, soaring food prices, and the country's debt shows a different strategic approach has to be taken to resolve the challenges facing the country. When elected, Ayariga says he will transform the country to improve living conditions. He criticized the two leading parties, the governing New Patriotic Party, NPP, and the main opposition National Democratic Congress, or NDC, for contributing to the current economic conditions. He adds that high youth unemployment is a security threat to peace and stability. Hassan Ayariga tells me that Ghana's current debt portfolio is unsustainable and unacceptable.
Our debt stock is around 540 billion cedis. And funny enough, as a nation, we have nothing to show for this quantum borrowing. And I will say that we have mismanaged our country, a lot of wastage, a lot of corruption, and that is where our country is where it is.
People have expressed concern about the fall of the Ghanaian cedi, particularly against the US dollar, and prices of goods and services in the market have shot up. But Ghana is not the only country facing similar challenges. A lot of African countries and even wealthier nations are facing similar prevailing economic challenges. So why blame the government when everybody is suffering from external shocks?
Let me put this on record. Everybody is not Ghana. We have a lot of poor people in this country. The reason why the cedi depreciated against the major currencies is because we do not have value for our cedi. We do not make our cedi strong. We import almost everything in Ghana. And you cannot keep importing things and expect your cedi to be strong. We do not add value to what we have. That is our problem. Our problem is that we don't know what to do with our resources. Tell me one sector of our mineral resources that is managed by Kenya. Our oil is in the hands of foreigners, bauxite in the hands of corridor, timber in the hands of foreigners, cocoa. One industry that is being managed, even the banking sector, has been taken over by foreigners. So the only sector
If you speak like that, people will talk about you being xenophobic and inviting anger against foreigners who are investing in Ghana.
I have no problem with anybody investing in Ghana. I have problem when we give out everything and become 21st century slaves. Ghanaians and Africans have given our resources, which I call our wife, our mineral resources, which I call our destiny, our own, to the foreigners. We don't do that. We don't do that. You manage it yourself.
What is the way forward for the upcoming 2024 general election in Ghana, briefly?
You're talking about election 2024. What is there now to talk about election 2024? The few political parties, the NDC and the MPP, has brought us this far. A debt stock of $540 billion. An economy where the city is the worst performing city. An economy where people now, even food and goods of services have gone high, and the salary of workers are still the same. An economy where you buy toilet roll, 50 Ghana cedis, 50 Ghana cedis, one tissue. An economy where you buy pure water, 10 cedis. An economy where you buy bottled water, 20 cedis. And you think there's an economy to revive? Or you think there's a leader? Our best bid for 2024, as I speak now, it is not NDC, not MPP. It is APC, a third force that we are building together. We are bringing all the minority parties together to form a third force. And that third force will now run with the NDC and the MPP. And our best bid is a third force. Because nobody, we have seen the NDC. If and in an unlikelihood President Mahama comes back, what else is President Mahama going to do new within 3-4 years that we haven't seen? If the NPP elect any leader, what else are they going to do? Even breaking the aid, they're talking about breaking the aid. They should not talk about breaking. They should be concentrating on finishing the aid, because that's the most difficult aspect of it. Are you with me? So election 2024, I am appealing to Ghanaians in the diaspora. They have listened to the NDC. They have given NDC power. They have listened to the MPP. They've given MPP. Let's make a change. Change is always the best thing to embrace when there are difficulties. And that change is that the people here living in America and other countries listen to you. Let's move on and vote APC and Dr. Hassan Ayariga for a change in 2024. That's just the way forward.
Hassan Ayariga is the leader of the Ghanaian Opposition All People's Congress, or APC. He spoke with me from Northern Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. In Djibouti, exiled opposition leader Daher Ahmed Farah, head of the main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Renewal and Development, has returned home. He departed Belgium, where he stayed for years, and arrived in the capital Djibouti city on Thursday, years after staying abroad. This following concerns for his personal security as an opposition leader and an avowed government critic. Farah says although he still has concerns for his personal security, he decided to return home to join fellow citizens to contribute to the country's development. In an op-ed he posted on his social media platforms, Farah expressed concern about what he calls the narrowed political space. He tells me that his party will not participate in the coming elections.
This move is not safe, as I wrote it in my text. But I have to go back home in Djibouti because people, both those of my party and the other Djiboutians, need me to be there. We need to get reunited to ground and to find ways to get our country out of its current situation.
In your article, you said your party is the most persecuted. Some people are saying that you are trying to get Western sympathy by saying your party is the most persecuted, and that elections that are being organized in February are usually free. Other opposition parties participate without any problem, and that is why you are even going or coming to Djibouti. What they are saying is that this is just a publicity stunt for you to gain sympathy from Western nations.
The fact that our party is the most persecuted one in Djibouti is a reality. There are facts. we don't say anything other than facts. And if I go back there, I go back home there in Djibouti, it's not because we want to take part in the so-called upcoming elections. There aren't elections in Djibouti, whether parliamentary or presidential, because the elections in my home country are not fair and free. The government itself, the power in place itself, recognized it in 2014 by signing a political agreement in which they agreed to put in place an independent national electoral commission, a joint one, made up both of opposition members and government members. So this is the reality. We are not trying to get any publicity from anybody. We are just saying things as they are.
All right, but if you don't participate and other opposition parties participate in the upcoming elections, wouldn't that give it legitimacy? The reason why you are not participating will not be achieved?
The credible opposition doesn't want to participate in these so-called elections. The credible. There are maybe a few so-called opposition members who declared their willingness to take part in the so-called elections, but those are not credible. The observers know that in Djibouti, as well as elsewhere in Africa, there are opposition, two kinds of opposition. Those who are sincere, reliable, consistent, and the others who are in the opposition just to draw the attention of the ruling party and to get some material advantages like money and so on.
What happens to your political party since your party is not participating in the upcoming parliamentary election?
Once back there home in Djibouti, we will see together both our party and the other credible opposition parties. We will see what to do to help our country get out of its very sad situation. So I am going back home there to get reunited with my fellow party members, with my fellow opposition members, to take what it takes to help our country.
If the officially the ban has not been lifted in Djibouti, wouldn't you be committing an illegal act by meeting members of your group in the name of the group while you are in Djibouti?
It's not illegal. Well, when I go back there in Djibouti, I will get in touch with the Minister of Interior and other authorities and say, look, this is a decision of international of human rights UN Human Rights Committee. We won. You know it. So implement it, please.
Daher Ahmed Farah is head of the Djibouti Main Opposition Party, the Movement for Democratic Renewal and Development. He spoke with me from Djibouti. Algerian authorities have jailed a prominent journalist and closed his website and radio station. The Associated Press says an investigating judge ordered Isani El Kadi, an activist in the Hirak pro-democracy movement in 2019, to be kept in custody. He was detained on December 23 and held since then in a police facility. The AP says his case is linked to crowdfunding used to finance his media outlets, Maghreb Emergent and Web Radio,
both of which are not recognized by the government as official media organizations. El Qadi is charged with receiving funds that incite acts susceptible to threatening state security, stability, and fundamental interests, a charge that could lead to up to 7 years in prison. The AP says his arrest is part of an ongoing trend of cracking down on dissenting voices. One Algerian journalist lamented, Algeria is sliding into an Orwellian universe. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first,
next level music.
Chewy! Chewy!
Gucci, baby.
Vani boy.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Stop acting funny. Say you know they pick my color, don't call you 10 times. Yeah, I love you. Even when I don't say it alive, no. Yeah, I miss you. Even when I don't say it wrong, no. Who's in a big cut of Jennifer? Let's see, they do the daddy that girl, Jennifer. Oh, I'm looking for that girl called Jennifer. Now she is spoiling.
Tears on your face, come down. I don't feel good and I see my baby crying. And I got love for you, believe me, I mean it, I don't wanna lie. You talk about Jennifer, she the daughter of my aunt called Monica. Nothing going on, she's my sister. I'm not a terrorist, I'm the America. Hey, hey, hey. Niki lala no masimu si so yele, unacheze moto. Kuna message zao na video zao, moyo utaupa joto. Unanifuta nyuma nyuma taki nitembe, yani kila chocho. Misho uje nifuma kwao, nikifanya nao, yes tigongo la mboto.
Mucha na ai.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Tracy Carter, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, you do not teach the paths of the forest to an old gorilla. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.